Speaker!
Order, order.
Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to introduce the Member's Bill in my name to increase New Zealand's refugee quota and for the bill to be set down for the first reading as Member's Order of the Day number one.
Leave is sought for that purpose. Is there any objection?
Yes, so late.
There is objection.
Green Party MP Denise Roche's attempt at the start of the week's sitting on Tuesday to introduce legislation in response to the Syrian refugee crisis may have fallen flat at that first hurdle, with only one voice of dissension needed to block the tabling of any document in the House. But the government's humanitarian response to the refugee crisis was an ongoing theme of the week, featuring in questions to ministers as well as a briefing in the Select Committee rooms. First, there were questions to the Immigration Minister, Michael Woodhouse, on Tuesday from Greens co-leader James Shaw, who was unsatisfied with the government's announcement the previous day of an emergency intake of 750 Syrian refugees.
Why should the public trust the National Party to increase the refugee quota in a meaningful long-term way when as late as last week they refused to even consider an emergency quota and in the past have lobbied to cut the number of refugees that New Zealand takes?
The Immigration Minister, Michael Woodhouse, said the emergency intake was only part of the government's response.
The member has something of a fixation on the quota and of the number 750. I remind the House that that is one part of the government's humanitarian response, including another 300 places in family reunion, the 250 or so convention refugees that are granted asylum every year, and the emergency places that have been announced this week, in addition to significant other humanitarian contributions. On top of the $15 million that the government had already provided to assist the Turkish government in supporting refugees on their border, another $4.5 million was announced this week. And I think that is a very, very good contribution above the 750.
Mr. Shaw also questioned why the government had blocked the tabling of Denise Roche's members' bill.
If his government has such an open mind, why did he vote down the Green Party's bill and stop public consultation on the refugee quota at Select Committee?
The Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Well, Mr. Speaker, while I have no responsibility for either of those things, I am aware that the Foreign Affairs Select Committee is hearing four submissions on that very issue this week.
And that briefing on the current situation for refugees in New Zealand took place on Thursday morning, when the committee heard from several refugee support groups, including the Refugee Council of New Zealand, represented by refugee advocate Tracy Barnett.
As a journalist, I have to believe in stories. So let me tell you this one in three simple scenes, and I'll let you decide the ending. But also, as a columnist and even more lowly life form, I deal in something far more elusive than truth. I deal in perceptions, that elusive gold of pretend political sophistication that too often trumps facts. I enjoy seeing New Zealand from a bird's eye view, tracking what the world press has to say about us in the international community. So let me hold up a different mirror to ourselves. And up until a few short years ago, when I was writing a book on refugee issues in New Zealand and our region, our reputation was fairly robust. Our intake was minuscule, but worldwide, our processes and our appeal system was widely seen as healthy and fair. We quite rightly allow asylum applicants to wait in the community for their cases to be heard. Indeed, it's the more moral and, who knew, cheaper solution. It actually pays to be fair. In short, we've been seen as the country that's doing it right at the bottom of the world. But one day, a strange thing happened during the Prime Minister's press conference in 2012. Let me set the scene, because what our Prime Minister said that day absolutely astounded me. But before I tell you what he said at the podium that day, bear with me if I give you three simple facts, something that I think all my colleagues here in the refugee community and throughout the world would not dispute as being what is simply the basis of refugee ideas. I'll be quick, and no, there won't be a test. Number one, seeking asylum is a legal right here in 147 other countries. It doesn't matter how you get here. If you apply through the process, it doesn't matter if you come by surfboard. So number one, seeking asylum is a legal right. Number two, there is no such thing as a queue. It's a myth. It doesn't exist and it never has. Resettlement is not first come, first serve. It's more like rolling triage, needs-based first. So if you are very comfortably settled in a camp on the Thai-Myanmar border, for example, the UNHCR may have to turn and urgently address the needs of Syrians, and you may be stuck there for years, indeed decades. So no such thing as a queue. And finally, the last one. Detention does not equal deterrence. Research all over the world, from Australia to Oxford to, I could name many, many institutions, have shown that if refugees have to choose between certain death at home or even the chance of life in a boat, they will choose life every time, even if they know they're going to be locked up at the end of it. Research shows that most don't even know the detention policy of the country that they're sailing to. They're so at the hands of their traffickers. So, let me bring you back to that day, 2012, and what the Prime Minister said that day. Words, the precious commodity of my profession, are important here. This is what our Prime Minister said. He was introducing a bill that would, in essence, amount to mandatory detention for any future boat arrivals. He said these people were illegals. He said these people were queue jumpers, and he used that phrase. And he said we were doing it to deter arrivals. What was really going on here? Why had New Zealand suddenly lifted a page verbatim from Australia's highly inflammatory playbook? That wasn't us. Those of us in the New Zealand refugee sector scratched our heads. We knew we already had detention provisions in our existing laws. Other countries were surprised too. Why would a country that has never had a boat arrival, at least in modern history, suddenly be so fearful if a boat actually did make it to our shores one day? This, just for saber rattling? The bill passed, quietly. But something very tangible changed that day. Suddenly, there was a big question mark over the perception of New Zealand and refugees. Were we really an independent voice in the region? Or was New Zealand suddenly falling under the pull of Australia's highly derided imprisonment policies? Quietly, no one was quite sure. Let me take you to scene number two. This time, it's early 2013. Our Prime Minister is coming out of a summit, and then Prime Minister Julia Gillard are both in Queenstown. John Key announces New Zealand will accept 150 of Australia's refugees. Note, not UNHCR's refugees. Julia Gillard says that along with intelligence sharing, New Zealand has been invited to send any future boat arrivals to Nauru and Manus Island. John Key calls this, quote, a good deal for New Zealand. Now, our cousins across the Tasman have been quite open about trying to sell their human rights obligations to developing countries who need the cash. Their people-selling business is working, too. Nauru, PNG, and now most recently in Cambodia. After Queenstown, those in the international refugee community began to wonder openly, is New Zealand now choosing to endorse Australia's contentious detention policies? Finally, my third scene, my last one. Our Prime Minister is standing on the stage of a press conference at the Gallipoli commemorations in Turkey. Turkey, the country that is hosting 1.8 refugees right now, staggering under this weight. John Key is asked, well, will New Zealand consider raising its quota? Our Prime Minister didn't hesitate. Not likely, was his response. He thought our intake of 750 was, quote, just about right. This, standing on the stage of a country that is hosting more refugees than not quite double the size of the population of the South Island. Now, I honestly believe our Prime Minister left the press conference that day having no idea of the perception he left behind him on the world stage that day. How his response sat, not just with the Turkish people, but to other countries around the world. Perceptions. What was the perception of New Zealand's reputation on the world stage just 2 short weeks ago? You see, here's where my shiny new Kiwi pride truly lives. It lives in the 82% of Radio Live listeners, not raging leftist listeners, who polled that we need to take more refugees, from a Sean Plunkett poll, no less. It lives in the young Nats who rallied to raise the quota in petitions they initiated. It lives in New Zealand's Psychologist Society, who are now filling a petition to ask the New Zealand government to speak out about Nauru and Manus. Why? They can't understand why Australia has seen fit to make reporting of child abuse on Nauru not mandatory, or why a new Australian law says that any medical personnel, indeed any employee, who talks to the press about conditions on Nauru or Manus will now face up to 2 years in jail. This despite reports of sexual grooming of children by guards. This despite reports of rape and sexual favors forced upon women and children. This despite endemic suicide attempts, including a five-year-old recently. This despite one whistleblower who recently testified that guards, former Australians, and yes, Kiwi soldiers who served in Afghanistan had waterboarded and zipped refugees. Zipping being where they zip plastic zip line wrists and ankles to a bed frame and then drop it from a great height with force. Now, I certainly can't confirm any of this firsthand because the Nauru government charges $8,000 just to apply for a press pass, whether it is granted or not. And what, pray tell, has New Zealand said about any of this publicly? Not a word. Our silence has been deafening. Until just last week, Murray McCulley issued a statement. We would be cutting $1.2 million in funds from Nauru's judiciary. And lo and behold, after years, I'll show you what proactive leadership really looks like. From one simple headline in the Sydney Morning Herald, it read, quote, Abbott government under pressure to cut Nauru aid after New Zealand crackdown. Under pressure because of New Zealand's actions. At the same time, Kiwis started to look in the mirror and weren't sure they liked what they saw. Our self-perception as fair brokers on the world stage didn't add up to reality. Not when we ranked 90th in the world for the total number of refugees we host per capita, 116th by our GDP. What you saw last week was a strange disjoint between the government's perception of what we thought the public wanted and the actual compassion of average Kiwis, and I might add, importantly, across party lines. I speak to you as a purveyor of perceptions with a simple plea. Don't underestimate the compassion or the goodness of the New Zealand public, of that silent majority. Don't let passive inaction define our refugee policy. Turn around some of these haplessly mixed messages we're sending out onto the world stage. First, find a way to state clearly that New Zealand will have no part in Australia's offshore detention regime ever. Make this statement clear enough so there is no ambiguity. Make our independent position clear. We want no part in their toxic international reputation for offshore refugee imprisonment. We shouldn't be lumped in their boat. And finally, don't believe that this new emergency 600 intake will be all that's required to bolster the public self-worth. Make a commitment to raise the quota permanently so we can build the sector's infrastructure long-term. Just wait. In comparison to the dramatic quota increases we're seeing throughout the world, even from countries about our same population size, next year's stats are going to prove just how mean that 600 figure will look in hindsight. Additionally, create support for those outside of the aegis of the government, the small little organizations who have been stripped of government fundings, for example, the Auckland Refugee Council, 16 beds in a hostel that will suffer under the weight of more refugees. Create a grant program that will take care of them in the next three-year cycle. The truth is, when our government now says we have no capacity, what you really mean is that you aren't willing to build the capacity. Change that reality and make sure you match your commitment to raising the quota permanently with funding to a sector that has suffered from decades of neglect. Today, the dirty truth is, even if we double the quota to 1,500, still such a paltry number, with our almost 40% population growth and our 75% drop in asylum number arrivals since 9/11, that doubled number will only take us back to what we used to do per capita decades ago. But if I can leave you today with only one message that rings in your ears as you reach to turn off the bedside lamp tonight, it is this. This committee called the government out to take an urgent look at our refugee quota 3 weeks ago. I applaud that. Lead us. Lead this region. Maybe that is what steered you into politics oh so long ago. I will go home tonight and think about what column I can write that will turn into someone's fish paper by dinner time. You have the incredible privilege to determine what actions will define us. I can't think of a more noble, more clearly humanitarian, moral imperative we can be proud of than that.
Refugee advocate Tracy Barnett speaking to the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee. Also in the committee rooms during the week, Reserve Bank Governor Graham Wheeler briefed the Finance and Expenditure Committee on his announcement on Thursday morning of a drop in the official cash rate, or OCR, which effectively sets banking interest rates.
As you know, we reduced the official cash rate by 25 basis points to 2.75%. A reduction in the OCR is warranted by the softening in the economy and the need to keep future average inflation near the 2% target midpoint. At this stage, some further easing in the OCR seems likely. This will depend on the emerging flow of economic data.
Graham Wheeler also warned the committee of the effects of rising house prices in Auckland.
The house price to income ratio for Auckland is at 9. It's twice that for the rest of the country. And a ratio of 9 puts you in the top 10 most expensive cities in the world. So this is just dangerous territory.
The Reserve Bank Governor's comments on Auckland housing were later the subject of questions in the chamber from Labour's finance spokesman Grant Robertson to his government counterpart.
Does he stand by his statement that the government has left nothing undone to tackle skyrocketing house prices in Auckland, given the Reserve Bank Governor's call today for more to be done to address the lack of supply in the Auckland housing market?
Stepping in for Finance Minister Bill English was Associate Minister Stephen Joyce.
Well, Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, if the member's been paying attention, the government is working very hard on the Auckland housing market.
That drew this further question from Grant Robertson.
In light of that answer, was the Reserve Bank Governor wrong when he told the Finance and Expenditure Select Committee less than an hour ago that the Auckland housing market is in dangerous territory?
Stephen Joyce.
Well, Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, not necessarily at all, and I think
It is important for people to understand, if they're buying houses, that actually you can pay too much for a house. And there are risks, because although interest rates are very low at the moment, they don't stay low forever, and people generally stay paying off their houses for a very long time. So I think it is appropriate for the Reserve Bank Governor to make comments about housing prices in Auckland, because people don't want to make the decisions to pay too much.
Later, Green Party finance spokeswoman Julianne Genta questioned the value of having the official cash rate set by a single Reserve Bank Governor.
Does he agree with the Treasury's advice to him that said, quote, the current single decision-maker approach poses risks, and that, quote, on balance, we think there would be benefits to moving towards a monetary policy committee in the future?
That question was again fielded by Stephen Joyce, who said he had read the Treasury's advice.
But it is important to note that the New Zealand system has served us very well, I think, over the last 26-odd years.
Back in the committee meeting, Graham Wheeler was quick to point out to Ms. Genta that the setting of the official cash rate wasn't his decision alone and was informed by a committee.
So in the end, the decision gets taken by the four governors meeting in a committee, another committee from the separately from the 13. Now, as I said this morning, there hasn't been one example in more than 10 years that I'm aware of, not one example of a decision being taken that was not the majority decision of the 13 that gave advice to the Governor or the Governing Committee. That's how we do it.
Reserve Bank Governor Graham Wheeler explaining the process for the setting of the official cash rate to the Finance and Expenditure Committee. Also making headlines during the week was the shutdown of Kaitaia Airport by a group of protesters unhappy with the provisions of treaty settlement legislation, which was being debated as the House sat in extended hours on Wednesday morning. Speaking on the third reading of the Te Hiku Claims Settlement Bill, Treaty Settlement Negotiations Minister Christopher Finlayson had a typically blunt assessment of the protesters.
There is no place for this kind of oafish behaviour. There are a few miscreants who are doing it. They don't reflect Ngāti Kahu. I hope that the day will come very soon when the miscreants will get lost and Ngāti Kahu negotiators will sit down with the Crown to sort out these arrangements.
Treaty Settlement Negotiations Minister Christopher Finlayson speaking on the Te Hiku Claims Settlement Bill, which along with the Te Kararau Aumaki Claims Settlement Bill passed its final reading on Wednesday morning. This week, the government also passed the Taxation, Land Information and Offshore Persons Information Bill, which was split into two bills for its final reading and passed with the support of all parties except New Zealand First. That legislation brings into effect the government's budget announcements around the purchase of residential land for speculative profit and requires offshore persons to provide IRD numbers and bank account details when purchasing residential investment properties. Elsewhere in the week, back in Question Time, opposition criticism of the government's flag referendum continued on Thursday, with questions for the Arts, Culture and Heritage Minister from Labour's Jacinda Ardern.
Was she, as Minister of Arts, Culture and Heritage, consulted during the flag design process, and is she satisfied with the outcome as one of the responsible ministers?
Fielding that question on Maggie Barry's behalf was her government colleague, Nikki Wagner.
On the behalf of the Minister of Arts, Culture and Heritage, no, I was not consulted during the flag design process, which was deliberately kept at arm's length from ministers to ensure its independence. The flag consideration panel was established to conduct an independent process to engage with New Zealanders about alternative flag designs and to choose four to appear in the ballot paper for the first referendum. Yes, I am satisfied with the outcome. The flag consideration panel has undertaken its work conscientiously and chosen what it considers the four best alternative flag designs.
There was then a series of further questions to the Minister from Jacinda Ardern.
Did she, as Minister for Arts, Culture and Heritage, recommend any designers or artists for the flag consideration panel, and if so, who?
Nikki Wagner.
No. The flag consideration panel included New Zealanders with a variety of backgrounds and areas of expertise, and they took advice from designers.
Jacinda Ardern.
Did she recommend anyone for this flag selection advisory group? a group that included the creative director from Nike? If so, who?
Nikki Wagner.
On behalf of the Minister of Arts, Culture and Heritage, as I'm not the minister concerned, I'm unable to answer that question.
Jacinda Ardern.
What is her response to those who have called for the Red Peak option to be included in the referendum?
Nikki Wagner.
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Arts, Culture and Heritage, there has been a robust process involving public input, and I'm satisfied with the outcome. Red Peak was considered by the panel along with a number of other designs, and the panel made its decision on the final shortlist. I am interested to see that the UMR research poll of 1,000 New Zealanders ranked the red flag 37th out of 40, nearly the worst.
Jacinda Ardern.
Did she consult with the RSA as the minister responsible for World War I commemorations, or indeed anyone else, before she adopted a position in support of the Lockwood option, which she has been wearing as a badge since Monday and hanging in the front of her electorate office?
Order. The question's been asked. The question's in order.
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Arts, Culture and Heritage, I'm not the minister concerned, so I'm unable to answer that question directly, but I'm very pleased to see that the Labor Party is taking an interest in the referendum, and I hope they will support the right of every New Zealander to have an opinion.
And there was also this question from the ACT Party's leader and sole MP.
David Seymour.
Is the minister concerned that colourblind voters will effectively only have three options to vote for with the current lineup?
The Honourable Nikki Wagner.
No.
This week also saw a round of tributes led by Deputy Prime Minister Bill English to the country's head of state, the Queen, having become the longest-serving British monarch.
Previously, Queen Victoria held that record, reigning for 23,226 days. Well, 63 years and 7 months, Queen Elizabeth surpasses that record today.
A round of well-wishing speeches followed, including one from Labor leader Andrew Little.
For the record, and I don't want to embarrass the Acting Prime Minister on his numbers and his calculations, but for the record, Her Majesty achieves this great milestone at 4:30 tomorrow morning, New Zealand time, which raises an obvious question as why we haven't had legislation in this House allowing Her Majesty's loyal subjects in New Zealand to raise a glass of PIMS on licensed premises at that time so that we can all celebrate the very special occasion. I regard it as an epic fail on the part of the ardent monarchists in this House.
Andrew Little. And now for a preview of the week ahead, here's Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee.
When the House resumes on the 15th of September, it's the government's intention to progress a number of first readings on the order paper, including the Māori Purposes Bill, the International Finance Agreements Amendment Bill and the Child Protection Sex Offenders Register Bill. Mr Speaker, Wednesday will be a Members' Day.
Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee. And the House will also sit in extended hours on Thursday morning to make progress on 4 government notices of motion and 2 government bills. I'm Rhys Lyon reporting for ParliamentToday.co.nz with funding from Parliament.